I'm David Halpin, a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon, and I live down in on the edge of Dartmoor, a beautiful spot. You speak of David Kelly. I was involved with him from the word go, well, not with him, with the investigation of his unnatural death from about, from December the 16th, 2003. I wrote a little letter to the Morning Star, knowing I support the Morning Star anyway, but I knew no other paper would publish the letter, and in this short letter I said that I didn't wish to cause any discomfort to the grieving family, but I did want to express my doubt that this man could have died from hemorrhage caused by the cutting of his wrist, however deep. Went on to say that I found it, I didn't use the word preposterous, but I found it difficult to understand how a man with his scientific knowledge would have chosen such a most uncertain way to end his life. That is, with coproximal tablets, which were allegedly from his wife, who had rheumatoid arthritis or something similar, and an allegedly not sharp pruning knife. And that letter led me into a little group of people. One, a lady who wasn't medically qualified, called Rowena Thursby, and a fellow called Stephen Frost, who was an interventional radiologist from Sweden. He's a British graduate, but he'd been in Sweden, had a Swedish wife. And an increasing group of other doctors came in. And they all had appropriate specialties in considering how this man could have died in this way, whether the investigation was sufficient, and if it wasn't sufficient, what should we do about it? The key fellow was Searle Sennett. This gives you some idea of the reach. He was a retired anaesthetist from Johannesburg, British trained, like Barts, I think, and he felt very strongly that Kelly had not, he thought it was highly unlikely he'd taken his life. And being as an anaesthetist, he was more used to considering body chemistry. And he was also a very good researcher. We questioned each other. It was a very scientific group. It wasn't, as they would paint us, a conspiracy theorist group. And Searle was very good in his research. Remember, he looked at 40 papers to investigate the question of what happens to morphine or morphine analogues, morphine-like drugs, when you sample the tissues or the vessels after death. And, you know, it came up with a remarkable, I can't remember the figures now exactly, but, you know, morphine will increase by something like tenfold within 24 hours of death. So that, things like that, and the more central you're sampling, say, from the vena cava, from the main vessel in the abdomen, that was could also be elevated artificially because of proximity, closeness to the gut, where the drug was lying, if it had been taken in by the gut.
So why was that significant, that information?
That, about the morphine, well, the thing is that dextropropoxifene is the drug which is in coproximal, and it's a morphine-like drug. And he was, as it happened, Dr. Allen, who was the forensic pathologist, forensic chemist, I can't remember the exact title, the levels of these two agents, the paracetamol doesn't kill you anyway, initially. It kills you about 5 days later with liver failure. So some of these poor youngsters who take paracetamol overdoses die terribly on about the sort of seventh day. So forget the paracetamol, but the dextropropoxifene was something like a third of the normal of the level which he would normally associate with death. Now, the thing is that he, of course, is mostly seeing, he's not seeing live people surviving in the hospitals, he's seeing corpses. So even that has to be balanced. You know, don't go cantering off into that response. It might not be that significant, that, and some people have put a lot of weight on that, but that's what he found. He said it was about a third of the level he's associated with death. There's a little question mark, or a big question mark, attaching to that, and that is that the dextropropoxifene, this morphine analogue, can cause arrhythmia, and people can die of that. and they made a great play of this. Some of the people who were trying to...
That's an irregular heartbeat, is it?
Yes, irregular heartbeat. The people who said that, yes, I should have said that, the people who were saying that, Professor Milroy and Forrest, they were trying to undermine our case. Our case being that we wanted a proper inquest for this, our most senior, most experienced germ warfare and chemical warfare expert. He had full clearance by the CIA. He was being considered for I don't know much about honours and have no little respect for them, but he was being considered, I think, for a KCFMG, something like that. He already had two. He had his MD, and he also had some honour from the state, which I have just forgotten for the moment. But this was a very widely respected man who'd been to Iraq 37 times. He debriefed the Russians after Perestroika with their very, so we're told, very extensive germ warfare, chemical warfare projects. And he was known in many places, I think.
But you can't really criticise other doctors who are criticising you. That's just a tight peer review. Surely that's exactly the sort of thing that you must stand up and you must answer their questions.
No, we've done it. Of course I can't criticise them. But it was the manner in which it was done, partly. And I can't remember the details especially. But I remember that it came down in one case to Professor Milroy, who's had some interest in the mass graves, so-called, in Yugoslavia. It came down eventually to saying that people can die of bleeding from the ulnar artery. We wanted to know who they were. To some interest, you know, that when I was first raised this question, one of our friends has a son who's a pathologist. His girlfriend was training in forensic pathology in Cardiff, and she was back quick as a flash. People can die from a cut ulnar artery. Well, I don't believe it. What I would need to see is the notes. What were the circumstances? And I do not believe there wasn't some other factor like drugs involved.
So what about other circumstances? Have people, because you're doing this work, come to you with other circumstances that cause you to question the death of David Kelly as being suicide?
They haven't come to me. I've just, my antennae have become more active, longer, moving around more, and not in, I don't think, some, again, the conspiracy theorist way. I am aware that our state is subverting law right, left and centre. I don't like that. The law matters to all of us, and it matters to me. I don't like untruth, Tony, at all. And I've become interested in the so-called 7/7 bombings, which every so often are repeated particularly on the BBC, and they're always, in fact, tied to the word Islamic fundamentalists. And yet the proof of who planted those bombs, explosives or whatever, has not been forthcoming. There's been no inquests on any of the 52 subjects, and none on the four alleged, inverted commas, terrorists, the ones who came from Luton on the train, the delayed train. And there's been no inquests and no public inquiry, just a commentary. And there's been something recently which I haven't read, a commentary from the senior Home Office cipher, which is not our law. Our law requires inquests in all unnatural death. If there is mass death, as in this case, at three sites, I think it was, or four sites, then you would have a public inquiry with what was attached, in fact, to Dr. Kelly. Section 17A was attached to him. It was irrelevant to Dr. Kelly.
What is Section 17A?
Well, it allows for a public inquiry to consider a group of deaths, a number of deaths together, to save distress to the relatives, because it's not being worked over one after the other, and also for economy of effort. So you say this was this train crashed at Clapham or at Southall, and that was appropriate. It's been applied to Southall, actually. It was applied to the Gaul, the trawler that sunk off the North Cape, I think. It's been applied twice to that. and someone and one other scene, but for Kelly it was supplied. This is a single death. Extraordinary setup, really.
What is the normal circumstances following a death like David Kelly's, which is suspicious? Can you just run us through that?
Well, what particularly a death of a man like Kelly, you know, who had there was a great deal of voltage applied to it. A man who was the most senior weapons scientist in the country, been much involved with Iraq, been involved with say with Russia. He'd given advice to Israel actually on how much media I think Iranians would require to grow on, I don't know, anthrax bacillus or something like that. So he was widely known. So this high-profile man, whatever, our law requires that the scene would be sealed off immediately the corpse was found. The police, in fact, would photograph everything. I can't tell you all the fingertip search, all the rest of it. They'd be looking for things like if it was coproximol, blister packs in his coat as they found. You'd look for the little silver, you'd look for in case some of the little bits of silver had fallen off and were on the ground. That wasn't looked for, we understand. There's one tiny example. And you would attend, a pathologist would attend as soon as he was able to. In this case, the body was found about, I think, 8:20. And the pathologist, Dr. Hunt, I forget where he came from now, he attended at noon, by which time there were two tents, one near the body and one outside in the field for writing notes and things, that is, if you look through the Hutton Inquiry. And he then spent 7 hours with the corpse making observations, looking at things. Interestingly, he chose to, I mean that, he chose, I don't know if he chose sort of whether just an omission, he measured the body temperature at the end of the 7 hours, thereby widening, broadening the window for which he would estimate the time, the possible time of killing, death, not killing, death. Be logical about it. But that's one little aspect of it. And then the body would be removed. Once all evidence on the site was examined very closely and recorded in meticulous detail, then the body would be removed, as it was to John Radcliffe in a mortuary, and he started his post-mortem at about 9:20, I think. We don't know who was there in the mortuary. Dr. Hunt, Nicholas Hunt, was 9 years qualified. He'd been 2 years on the Home Office books as a forensic pathologist, and he had studied in forensic pathology, or in pathology, from, I think, very early on in his post-graduate career. But, you know, we've always found it remarkable that a man who was really a pretty junior was given this great burden of examining the death, the unnatural death of Dr. Kelly. We don't know whether any other pathologists were present in the John Radcliffe mortuary. I think it was unlikely. There would have been a coroner's officer, probably, and he prepared his report. I understand from my colleague Stephen Frost is that in fact there's been 3 autopsy reports. Now I can't confirm that, but Stephen's rather good on detail, and he says that actually. And then the case proceeds. They take lung tissue to see if it was made to inhale chloroform to sedate him while they did something else to the man. And they took blood samples. They took lots of samples. Many of which have been retained by Thames Valley Police and which are not open to the public, were not publicised.
One wouldn't expect samples of David Kelly's blood to be available to the public, surely?
I think it would be available at the Hutton Inquiry. If I was in conducting an inquiry into his death, he was charged, Dr. Hutton was charged with inquiring into the circumstances in the circumstances of the death of Dr. Kelly. He wasn't charged with finding out exactly how he died or what might have caused his death. And in other words, the emphasis was on, in fact, on the media furore.
And the psychological pressure on him, maybe.
The BBC were in the frame, and Gilligan particularly. That's what it's about. The government were also in the frame for outing him and for people like Hoon talking about, no, it wasn't Hoon, it was another fellow called Kelly, actually, referring to as a Walter Mitty character. They tried to smear him in his death, disgracefully. So that's what would happen at the thing. And then, of course, they'd test the blood samples, test the little tissues and what have you, and to see what light they threw on his death. Let me go on a bit. This is what I would... you would, in fact, gather. You know that the operation, that the police operation, was labelled, it's just extraordinary, was called Operation Mason, for the search for him when he was reported missing at about 11 o'clock that night. But the search started, you know, that started half an hour before he left the house at 2:30 in the afternoon.
So is this the day before?
No, this is the day before his body was found, yes. His wife, I think the family, decided to alert the police at 11 o'clock that night. But we have not had an explanation, for instance, as to why Operation Mason should have started half an hour before Dr. Kelly left the house to go for his walk. Now, there's two things which have emerged in the last 6 months which I find extraordinary, and I find extraordinary that they don't open inquest, bang, like this. One of them is that Norman Baker, who I've given advice to about the medical aspects, some of the medical aspects about this, and who's written, apart from some of the conclusions, I think a very good book in assembling the evidence, Norman asked for the result of the fingerprint examination of the knife. No fingerprints on the knife. Now, you work that out, that there's a suicide who's got a knife, he's adrenaline circulating, he'll be sweaty, and he's got hold of a knife and he's trying to slit his wrist. So that's one thing. The second thing is that another chap, a journalist who has a name which is almost unbelievable, called Garrick, like Garrick Theatre, like the original thespian, Garrick Older, A-L-D-E-R, of the Bedfordshire on Sunday paper, decided, he got interested in this, and he asked for, under the Freedom of Information Act, for a report of the search helicopter's log. And it was released. Extraordinary it was. It was released. This is the second piece of evidence. And one helicopter was down for maintenance or something, and there was no infrared image at 2:30 in the morning over the wood where Kelly. Now, the exact location of the exact transit line of the helicopter, I can't tell you, but the evidence is that there was no infrared image. And we have wondered whether the foliage, it was July, whether the foliage would have obscured that. And Stephen understands from helicopter pilots who've used infrared that it's unlikely that that would have been obscured if there was a body there. Because we've always felt if we were examining what might have happened to him, it was not unlikely that, in fact, he was dealt with and then, in fact, taken down by helicopter to the place where he was found.
So what about the inquest? Because that was rather abruptly ended. It took a lot less time than an inquest would normally take.
Well, the inquest was opened by a man called Nicholas Gardner. And I can't remember the date of that.
He's the Oxfordshire coroner, I think.
Yes, and then it was subsumed. Then it was felt, I'm not sure it was subsumed into the Hutton Inquiry, in other words, taken within it. I don't think it was.
No, it was adjourned, I think, when they announced Hutton.
Yes, he adjourned the inquest after, I think, two hearings, very brief. I'm not sure even they were public. I'm not sure they were publicised. Then the Hutton Inquiry came out on March the 16th, I think it was, Nicholas Gardner opened inquest and shut it after 16 minutes. And I was being interviewed, actually, at the time. I could tell you a story about that, which is of some interest, the Sky people. He couldn't close it. There wasn't a hearing, so he couldn't say, right, we're finished. It was adjourned. And that was confirmed by Harriet Harman in 2005. But they've changed their tack on that. And I don't. There's something about it. Was they agreed to close it during the Hutton Inquiry, or something? There's a certain amount of shuffling going on. But I can always remember speaking about. I'm not sure whether it was during when we were expecting to hear. No, it was a BBC interview, but it was some other thing when the Sky came down. And they interviewed me about Dr. Kelly's death and the inquest that we wanted. And I gave what I thought was a very good interview to a chap I knew from the Dove and Dolphin Voyage who interviewed me then. He was all smart, shoes polished, most unusual. And they had this for about 40 minutes, in fact, and I spoke with some vigour. And do you know, as I was being filmed, the cameraman became paler and paler. They shot off at the end of it, back to Bristol, where the Sky office is, in fact, on some industrial estate, and not 1 second was shown, as far as I know. And I don't know what was going on or whatever. All I'm doing is saying what I feel as a doctor and citizen. And I'm not going to have untruth rule this land.